Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the fall, November specifically, of 2002, two American astronauts and a Russian flight engineer left Earth for what they expected to be a routine mission to the International Space Station. However, because of what happened the following February, it turned out that it was certainly not routine. It was in that year, February 2003, that the space shuttle Columbia was lost. And not only did that mean the loss of the crew that were aboard, for the men that were on the space station, they knew that it meant, at least for the moment, they were effectively marooned. The story of what happened and how they got home, and also a story of what daily life is like on the space station, is all told in a recent book that we'll be talking about in this part of Focus 580. The title of the book is Too Far From Home, A Story of Life and Death in Space. It is published by Doubleday, and our guest this morning is the author. His name is Chris Jones. He's worked for Esquire as contributing editor and sports columnist, became a writer at large when he won the 2005 National Magazine Award for feature writing for the story that, in fact, became the basis for this book that we're talking about. Previously, he was a sports writer for the National Post, where he won an award as Canada's Outstanding Young Journalist. His work has also appeared in the Best American Magazine Writing and the Best American Sports Writing Anthologies. He makes his home in Canada, in Ottawa. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Anybody's welcome to call. We just, as I try to say here at the beginning of every show, we just hope that people would be brief in their comments just so we can keep moving along. But anybody's welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Chris Jones, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I am well, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
You know, something that strikes me, I know that commentators said this after the loss of Columbia, and after also the loss of the other shuttle loss, the Challenger loss. I think that commentators were trying to remind us of something that maybe we should think about, but we don't, and that is space flight is dangerous. No doubt about it. It's incredibly dangerous, and that every time someone sits on top of one of those rockets and goes up, they're taking a big risk. Do you think, in fact, that that we do forget that space flight is dangerous and that it is something that we should never really forget? We need periodically to be reminded just the kind of risks that people take when they go into space?
Absolutely. You know, I think before Columbia, we sort of entered this kind of lull in a lot of ways where the space shuttle flights in particular were seen as routine. You know, launches and landings didn't receive a lot of coverage. Space travel had kind of, in some ways, lost its luster. I just don't think people were that interested. And in fact, the mission that carried these three guys, Expedition 6, to the International Space Station, was the shuttle Endeavour brought them up. It didn't even warrant a brief in papers like the New York Times. And, you know, that's fairly telling for me. But what I found out as I've sort of researched the book is that, you know, not to sound glib, but every time one of these things doesn't blow up, in some ways, it's a minor miracle. I mean, it's millions of parts put together by thousands of people. The shuttle is 85% gas. So if you take a pop can, I mean, the proportion of pop to can, that's the same proportion of gas to shuttle. I mean, essentially it's a bomb that they perch seven people on top of and then light it on fire. And, I mean, for them, it's worth every risk. For someone like me, you know, if people asked me before I started working on the book if I wanted to go to space, I would have said, sure. And now I would say, there's no way would you get me on that thing. It's like, I know too much now.
Well, that's, I think, one of the things that struck me when I was looking at the sections of the book where you're talking about the pre-launch activity. Mm-hmm. And everything that has to happen for them to get ready. It strikes me that, in a sense, that so many things have to go right. It's a wonder that they go at all.
Yeah, I mean, the smallest thing will mess everything up. Mm-hmm. And if you know, it's kind of like looking in the kitchen of a restaurant and realizing that the chef is a little funky. I mean, when you sort of go behind the scenes and you realize just how fragile and tender this machine is, yeah, it's a wonder that it works at all. I mean, for instance, one of the things that shocked me about it is when you see pictures of the shuttle, it's this giant seeming thing, especially when it's got the tank and the two solid rocket boosters attached to it. But down in Florida, there are little plastic owls guarding the space shuttle from woodpeckers, because a single hole from a woodpecker, and this has happened where a woodpecker did put a hole in the tank, I mean, that's enough to bring that thing down. Or even more recently, we had a hailstorm where some hail dings on the external tank, you know, really threatened the integrity of it. And, you know, again, it's one of those things where it seems like this huge, invincible thing, but when you really break it down, it is a fragile machine. I mean, it doesn't take much to knock it off its balance. Mm.
I read that, and as I mentioned, Far From Home, Too Far From Home, started out as a magazine article that you wrote for Esquire.
That's right.
And that you started thinking about this right away when you heard about the loss of Columbia, that the thing that you thought at that time, I'm sure that probably most everybody were thinking about the loss of the crew, and I'm sure that you were too. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, one of the first things that you thought about was the fact that there were these three men on the space station, and that if the shuttle, a shuttle, not that one in particular, but a shuttle would have been their ride home. If the shuttle fleet is grounded, as everybody would expect it, well, the shuttle missions are going to come now to an immediate halt until we figure out what happened, then that meant effectively that these three guys that were on the space station were stuck. They had no way home. And you right away you thought, wow, this is now here we got a story.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you're, I don't know how to explain this, when you're a writer, you're always looking for stories of human interest that involve people in extraordinary situations, because those are the situations those are the stories that people tend to bond to the best. And I'm actually a recovering sports writer, so, you know, I liked writing about sports because frequently, you know, there were stories of drama or people doing incredible things, and that's what I liked about it. I'm not a sports guy in the sense that I can tell you who won the batting title in 1979. I just like the drama of it. And when I was sitting watching, I just happened to be watching TV when Columbia was lost, I couldn't explain to you why, but I just immediately thought those guys who are in the space station must be having one heck of a day. And I didn't know who they were. I didn't know their nationalities. I didn't know their names. I didn't even know how many people were up there. But whoever they were, I just knew that, you know, they must be finding out about the shuttle. They must be finding out that they've lost seven friends. And then, yeah, we knew from Challenger that after an accident, the shuttle fleet will be grounded for a year, maybe 2 years. Who knew? And how are they going to get these guys back? And it was just one of those things. You know, I'm not a space guy, or at least I wasn't a space guy, so it was this flash of inspiration that I haven't been able to explain, but it's all worked out pretty well.
Well, it certainly was, certainly a very dramatic situation. I understand, though, that when you pitched this idea to your editor at Esquire, they were less than enthusiastic and said something like, well, how are you going to do that? How are you going to talk to them? How are you going to do this story?
I know. I pitched it that afternoon. I talked to my editor that afternoon, February 1st. It was February 1st, 2003. And he said, well, you understand that they're in space. And I sort of said, well, yeah, I guess they are in space. And, you know, I hadn't really thought it through. I just thought of these guys. And so we decided to leave it for a while. And then when they finally did come home, there were sort of small reports in my local paper that used words like dramatic descent, and it mentioned that they came home on a Russian vessel, and that these were the first Americans to return home on a foreign vessel ever, and the first Americans to return home on a capsule since the last Apollo mission in 1975, and all of those things, I thought, well, this even makes the story better in a lot of ways. So I pitched it again, and then at that point, my editor said, you know, it's too good a story. Someone else is going to write it before we can get it in the magazine, because it takes us 3 or 4 months to get something on the page. So we waited and waited and waited, and no one wrote about them. It was just one of those stories that, for whatever reason, slipped through the cracks. And selfishly, as a writer, I'm glad it did, because it allowed me to write about it. But another part of me was sort of angry by it that, you know, we spend weeks talking about Anna Nicole Smith, and, you know, I bet the vast majority of Americans don't know there are guys on the space station right now. And And this just seemed to be one of those stories that deserved attention, that just didn't get it.
Well, if you'd like to, that is, people who are listening, if you'd like to read the story, the book is Too Far From Home, A Story of Life and Death in Space, which grew out from this article that our guest Chris Jones wrote for Esquire. The book is recently published by Doubleday, and it's in the bookstores if you'd like to read it. And we do have somebody here who would like to join in the conversation.
Sure.
That's, people can do that, too. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Chris Jones, here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455. Also, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller in Champaign to talk with. Our line one. We'll go right there. Hello.
Hi. Good morning,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Jones. Where are you right now?
I'm in Ottawa.
Oh, do you stay there all the time?
It's my home. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I try to get out of here as much as I can in the winter, though.
Yeah. Do you fly? Right.
I do fly.
Yeah. Well, I liked your description of how fragile the space shuttle is, but I don't like to climb onto an aircraft because they're pretty darn fragile too. And when you think about, okay, so they put up three shuttles a year or something like that, 300,000 times a year, one of these complex paper-thin things with gas rushing out the back of them is hauling a couple of hundred people someplace or the other. So I think that's rather miraculous too, but I'll look forward to your book because more or less because of the miracle that the shuttle actually is. So.
It is, and that's something, you know, I'm guilty as much of anybody as taking things for granted. You know, when something's a part of your daily life, and as you say, you know, the same thing goes for our domestic flight, our, you know, flying on planes. And, you know, you look back 100 years ago, people would have been awed by something. You know, we just had this giant Airbus flying across the States. I mean, that's an incredible machine that we're sort of like, oh, that's pretty cool. And then we go on to, you know, watching The Amazing Race that night.
Is there an Airbus yet? I heard him talking about an Airbus that's going to haul 500 people.
Yeah, it came to the States yesterday. It's like a double-deck jumbo jet. I mean, this thing its wingspan is as wide as a football field. I mean, these are, like you say, they're incredible machines.
And you have to pour new runways at most places for them to land.
Yeah, a bunch of airports won't even take it. But I'm the kind of guy who, you know, astronauts, I sort of talk to them, you know, do you think about what you're stepping into? Do you think about the danger? And very few of them do. A few of them sort of confront it, but most of them sort of switch off.
How old were you when they went to the moon?
I was not alive when they went to the moon.
Yeah, well, you realize they did that with the technologies of the 60s?
No, I know.
I mean, they
and the Russian vessel that these guys came home on, you know, when we were on the moon, the Russians were flying the Soyuz capsule, and that's what they used to return on. And, you know, you hear something like, well, with the moon landing, that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had a 50% chance of not being able to leave the surface of the moon, and yet they went. And I'm glad there are people who are willing to take those risks. I think it's important, you know, for us as a species that we have those people willing to take that risk. I'm not that person.
Well, there's, you know, the world's still full of young men that want to be fighter pilots or NASCAR drivers, so I suppose the risk takers will be there.
Yeah, and again, I'm glad they are.
I'm just not one of them, and you're not either, right?
I am not. I'm happy to write about other people doing it.
Well, I don't want to take any more time, but this is a fun program. I'll be listening.
All right, well, thanks for the call.
Thanks very much.
That book. What was the title again?
Too Far From Home.
And it'll be on the paperback yet?
No, it's hardcover. I'm not sure when it'll be in paperback. It just came out on March 6th, so it's still hardcover at the moment.
Oh, okay. Well, I know I can get it at the library then.
Okay. I'm sure you
well,
can.
That
thanks for the call.
Any sales, but one reader. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Just, I have a couple of other people here I want to get to in just a second, but I want to have you talk a little bit about the space station.
Sure.
The space station is still something of a work in progress, although there have been people living on it since 2000.
Yeah.
And I think that it's not something I think that probably most people are really aware of, the fact that it's there, the fact that it has been people have been continuously living there since that time. What is it possible to say other than this is a laboratory experiment looking into the long-term effects of living in space, which is a goal in and of itself? What purpose is really served by the space station?
Principally, I mean, people at NASA and the people who inhabit it look at it as a stepping stone. That you're right, it is a lab. Right now, it's three modules, sort of cylindrical modules combined that's about 150 feet long, about 8 feet wide on the inside. One of those modules, one of the American modules, is Destiny, which is a scientific lab, and they do things like materials processing, or they grow plants and look at animals and weightlessness and so on. And the science is kind of weird. I mean, the science, I think, is partly what turns people off space travel, because it seems like such a minor thing to be doing and so much money to spend on. But the principal goal of these people who are up there is to learn how better to live in space and how to be content in space and how to make something like a moon colony or a Martian colony possible. We look at right now the astronauts in the space station are going up for 6 months. If we talk about a trip to Mars, that's sort of a two-year thing. And we have to learn how to adapt physically and also how to adapt psychologically to spending that length of time away from Earth. And that, I think that's the best way to sort of explain space station, that it's our testing ground to figure out how to do these other things that we want to do. So in some ways it's not as sexy as NASA would like it, because it's not the end goal. It's sort of one step along the way. But it's a pretty remarkable machine, and if your listeners go to NASA and they can look at pictures of it, it's an incredible piece of work. And when it's finished, it's been compared to the biggest construction project since the Great Pyramids. You can see it. If you go out in your backyard at the right time, you can see the space station flying overhead, this steady white light. And, we've essentially put another star in the sky. I mean, it's an incredible piece of work.
Our guest in this hour is Chris Jones. And his book is Too Far From Home, A Story of Life and Death in Space. It's published by Doubleday, and it is in part something of the history of the space station, or at least something about what life is like from day to day on the space station. But it particularly concerns the experiences of three men, those men who made up what was known as Expedition 6, two Americans and one Russians, who went up in November of 2002, and then when the next winter, in February 2003, Columbia was lost, they were stuck there because the shuttle program was grounded, and the schedule was that at some point, not that much further along from the time that the Columbia was lost, a shuttle was going to come back and get them, and that's the way that they were going to get home. As he explained, the story does indeed have a happy ending, because they did get home, but the story of how that all happened is in the book. So if you're interested, you can look for it. And also, questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Bloomington, Illinois is next as a caller, and that's our toll free line 4.
Yes, mm-hmm. I was curious about the long-term effects of being in space. I had read something by, I think it was an exercise manual by a physician who had treated some astronauts who were up in space for very long periods of time, and they experienced something like osteoporosis, where they lost calcium from their bones because they weren't experiencing gravity, something like that.
No, that's right. Space is, I was talking about how we adapt to living in space, and the problem is that all our lives, from the instant we're born, we're bred to deal with gravity. So, when you got out of bed this morning, you used muscles that fought gravity, that astronauts aren't using anymore. And they've done their best to sort of replicate gravity. The guys up in the space station do a few hours of exercise every day. There's a treadmill up there that they can strap onto. There's a machine that uses like rubber bands as resistance. But it still doesn't match gravity. And then there are other problems involved, such as, you're talking about that osteoporosis, bone decay. You lose calcium from your bones. And what happens is the body sort of starts synthesizing that calcium and turns the calcium into kidney stones. And I don't know if you've ever known anyone with a kidney stone, but this is not a pleasant thing. And if you acquire one while in space, there's no way to treat it, and you're in significant pain. The best way I can explain, how rigorous this is physically, there's over 100 astronauts in NASA's astronaut pool, and these are the best of the best of the best. I mean, they're physically in top shape, they're really smart, psychologically sound. They are exceptional people. Of them, only 25 are qualified to go to space station, because there's something physically that might, you know, go wrong. Mentally, there's something that is keeping them back from being a long-duration astronaut. So if you take, you know, this already exceptional pool, and then you have to whittle it down further, I think that, that sort of speaks to how difficult life in space can be.
Did some of the astronauts, in fact, get kidney stones who were up there?
None of these three got kidney stones, but astronauts, you know, this was one of those things that was discovered. The Russians are particularly good at long-duration flights. You know, they've been at it much longer than us and have learned these things. And several of their cosmonauts developed kidney stones or, like you say, had developed bone loss, you know, that was the equivalent of postmenopausal women. I mean, you take a really fit cosmonaut and all of a sudden they're decaying. And that's just a fact of space travel. And so, you know, again, talking about the space station being a stepping stone, we have to learn better how to adapt to life without gravity. I mean, that starts with something as simple as how do you eat breakfast, or how do you go to the bathroom, or how do you cut your hair or do laundry? And then it goes as far as how do we keep our bones intact? How do we keep our muscles from atrophying?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
No problem.
Thank you. Let's go to Belgium, nearby community, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I want to be as discreet and polite about this as I can, but with this recent problem with this female astronaut and her love triangle, what keeps that from happening at a low-altitude pleasure palace?
That's an excellent question. You know, people ask me this all the time because the mission that preceded Expedition 6, the three people who were up there before, it alternates. There's two Russians and an American, and then there's two Americans and a Russian. And there's been mixed crews. So the last mission was Expedition 5, was two Russian cosmonauts and an American female astronaut named Peggy Whitson. And people are always saying, well, what were they up to up there? and stories of space liaisons are sort of legendary in the sense that they've never been spoken publicly of. You know, there's no way to prove anything that's happened up there. But, you know, NASA has sent married couples up, and you have to assume that part of their experimenting involved, you know, how couples get along in space, I guess is the discreet way to put it. Because if we talk about something like, say, a voyage out of our solar system, you're talking about a trip that, the people who start that trip won't be the people who finish it. I mean, you're talking about generations of astronauts. I mean, we're talking Star Trek here, but, you know, that's the sort of thing that the long-term vision of space travel people have to look at. And I don't doubt for one second that there has been, space encounters in low orbit.
Well, what I was getting at was not really so much the encounters you're referring to, but, you know, there could be personal problems, you know, A and B and B and C and C and D and, you know.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Sorry. Well, this is another interesting thing where the Russians are particularly good at it. They put their long-duration crews through a series of psychological tests before they send them up, trying to match them, you know, almost like compatibility training. From things like, do you like the same music, to even they show, you know, colors, and do you react to red the same way? I mean, really in-depth stuff. The Americans don't do anything like that. The American program is more based on seniority and who's next in line. And in some ways, it's just fortunate that so far, most of the crews on the International Space Station have gotten along. And I think what binds, in some way, very different people, you know, in the case of Expedition 6, the people in my book, we have a Navy guy who'd been to space four times, you know, exactly what you think of when you think of an astronaut. We have a scientist who's more interested in how clouds are made and what's inside of a volcano and who had never been to space before. And then we have, you know, sort of the crazy uncle from Russia who can't speak any English and is a long-duration cosmonaut. And you put these three guys in a tin can, and luckily they get along. And I think what binds them is sort of their desire to live in space, their desire to be in space. You know, just as a little aside, one of the interesting things, you know, with the Lisa Nowak incident, NASA came out and they said, someone said, well, what if this happens in space? And they said, well, there's no weapons up there, and so you don't have to worry about that. You just tranquilize them, and then we tie them up. Well, that's a lie. I mean, first of all, there is a weapon up there. Underneath the seat of every Soyuz capsule, which is attached to the space station like a lifeboat, there's a double-barreled sawed-off shotgun shells, so that is up there right now.
What would you need a double-barreled shotgun for?
Yeah, my question, too. What, in space, what are you going to do with it?
Off-target, and the cosmonauts were attacked by a pack of wolves. So ever since then, the Russians have packed a little something under the seat. So that's up there. The other thing is, if someone really did go crazy up there, you wouldn't have time to tranquilize them and tie them up. I mean, someone has done the math. It would take, you know, someone really, you know, on the bend up there, about 15 seconds to destroy station and to kill everybody inside of it. You take a hammer to a window, and it's all over. And so, you know, as these people are sitting up there, and I can imagine over dinner sort of looking at each other saying, you know, how are you feeling today? You know, they just have to have this faith that everyone they're with is on the same page. And you know, the way I was talking about how it's always a miracle to me now that every shuttle doesn't blow up, for me it's a miracle that only Lisa Nowak in the history of the astronaut program has been fired for sort of instability. You know, I think that's really fortunate. I think as we go to longer duration missions, we're going to hear stories of problems in space. But so far, knock on wood or knock on metal, as the case may be up there, nothing has really surfaced yet.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Just to return for just a minute to sex in space. With apologies to those people who would say, this is public radio, you're not supposed to talk about stuff like that.
I'm really sorry. That's where my mind went on that question.
Well, but you're right. I mean, if you've thought at all about what life would be like living in the space station, as you say, confined in this tin can for weeks, if not months, the thought has to have crossed your mind. And I'm sure that there are people who have we have thought about, well, somebody had to be the first one to do it in space. I'll just ask the question, do you in fact think, is the general consensus when people get around to talking about these things, that in fact someone has had relations in space?
Yes. It's never been confirmed, but, you know, I don't know how the best metaphor here or analogy. You know how you look, people also talk about, you know, life on other planets, and you look up at the night sky and there are so many stars, so many planets, that the odds are somebody has to be out there. I think it's the same thing. You know, there's been long-duration missions since 1971. Someone in all that time has gotten busy up there. And again, you know, it's fun to sort of joke about, but I think there is also a serious kind of side to it. You know, not only talking about the psychology of it, I mean, how can we expect someone to go on a 10-year space mission, you know, celibate? Or there's also sort of this very real possibility of space missions lasting hundreds of years and you know, talking about adapting to a weightless environment, we're going to have to learn how to breed in space. And you know, when you take that as far as you can go, yeah, I mean, the answer has to be yes, someone has done it. Nobody knows who except the people who have done it. And I'm sure that's a story they're dying to tell, but we'll probably get in trouble for telling it. NASA doesn't like anything involving anything base to get out. You know, they don't like talking about poo-poo or pee-pee or barf or any of these things. And, you know, for me, these are the fascinating things about it. I'm not as interested in the machines. I'm interested in the people and how they adapt to life in space. I mean, it's incredible, this incredible place. And I think the more you can talk about things that the rest of us can relate to, the better it is for everybody, because it inspires interest and it also makes astronauts seem more human. Yeah. I hate the idea of these automatons being sent into space. I like knowing that they have thoughts and feelings and, you know, they go to the bathroom. I think that's important.
Well, I'm sure for people who are not scientists or not astronauts who are just thinking about it in terms of what's the basic day-to-day experience like, it doesn't take very long before you start thinking about all of those things that you do every day that you don't give a whole lot of thought to but are basic processes of life that are completely, because of the conditions, are completely different. This poses, you know, just eating. Something that we really don't think all that much about, you know, what you're going to eat and how are you going to do it, and doing all this in a weightless condition and everything else that you have to do. It poses challenges that in our daily life we never think about at all.
No, and you have to relearn everything that you do. I mean, there's virtually nothing that we do on a daily basis that isn't affected, in our case, by gravity, and in an astronaut's case, by weightlessness. And then it's not just the gravity. It's also issues like supplying or, you can't step outside, you know, without a lot of work. There's everything has to be relearned. I mean, something as simple as, you know, again, NASA hates talking about this, but something like 70% of astronauts, when they are launched into space, get sick. You know, 30% sort of feel sick, and another 40% actually throw up. And there's sort of what are comical stories of astronauts, you know, taking their helmets off and going to throw up in their helmet, the way we'd throw up in a bag. But, of course, it doesn't end up in the helmet. It ends up everywhere. But in that instant, you're bred to think, you know, if I'm throwing up, I throw it up into something. Well, that's not the case up there. And you know, or there's a ladder between decks on Columbia, and astronauts always go to use the ladder. Well, you don't need the ladder anymore. You can just float. All of these things, these are sort of massive adjustments that take part that these astronauts have to undergo. And the interesting thing is the ones who go up there for a long time, when they return to Earth, then have to do it all over again, you know, and suddenly they're learning again how to walk in gravity, and that's a difficult transition as well.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Chris Jones. We are talking some about what you'll find in his book, just recently published, Too Far From Home, A Story of Life and Death in Space. It's published by Doubleday, and it's in part an account of what life is like on the International Space Station, but also of the story of the men, two Americans and one Russian, the men of Expedition 6, who went up on the shuttle Endeavour in November of 2002, and then effectively were stranded in February 2003 when Columbia was lost. They did, in fact, make it home, and that story is in the book. Questions are certainly welcome. Our guest, Chris Jones, has written for Esquire as contributing editor, sports columnist. He won the 2005 National Magazine Award for feature writing for the story he wrote for Esquire that became the basis for this book. He's also been sports writer at the National Post, where he won an award as Canada's Outstanding Young Journalist. His work has also appeared in the Best American Magazine Writing and the Best American Sports Writing anthologies. He makes his home in Canada and Ottawa, and he's here joining us by telephone from there. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At the point when Columbia was lost, this was February 1st, 2003, how much, at that point, when had the men of Expedition 6 been due to come home? How much more time did they have at that point on the space station?
They were a little over halfway done a 14-week mission, so they had a little over a month before they were coming home. And, you know, for me, in some ways, the story starts on that day, because everything had gone so normally and routinely before then, and all of a sudden, they get a phone call. You know, they knew that Columbia was returning that day. It was in the backs of their minds. It wasn't something they were really thinking about. It was a Saturday, which is kind of a lazy day on station. You sort of do some cleaning and some puttering and a little science. And all of a sudden, you know, the line crackles, and there's someone from Houston saying, "We need you guys to stand by for a second." So they're floating around, and that happened fairly routinely, and so they're floating around and not really thinking of anything. And then a guy named Jefferson Howell, who's the head of the Johnson Space Center, got on the line and said, "Guys, I've got some bad news." And they knew, because it was him delivering it, exactly what the next words would be, which were, "We've lost the vehicle." And, you know, I can't imagine what that moment was like for them, where suddenly they're, you know, not only did they lose seven friends, but they'd lost their ride home, and they knew as well as anyone that a shuttle wasn't coming anytime soon. And, you know, for me, just being in that moment, you know, Donald Pettit, the science officer, he had twin boys who had turned two while he was up there. And suddenly he was facing the prospect of not seeing them again until they were four. And, you know, for me, it's just an incredible moment. I mean, it's tragedy, but it's also this drama, this open-ended mission suddenly in front of them. And how they dealt with it, I think, is, you know, one of the amazing things in the history of space travel in a lot of ways.
How long could they have made it? They would have had to have just the basic stuff. They would have had to have food. They would have had to have water. I'm not sure what else they would at least have to have that. How long could they have stayed there if they would have had to?
Well, in terms of supplies, there's an unmanned Russian freighter called the Progress that can send up food and water. And, in fact, one was sent up very shortly after Columbia. And that's enough to sort of get them by. It doesn't have nearly the volume of the shuttle, so there were concerns about, you know, whether they could sustain three guys indefinitely. And ultimately, they decided they could not. But they had enough supplies to go until at least June at that point. You know, the larger concern is how long could they last physically and whether, you know, 2 years was too long. Cosmonauts, Russian cosmonauts, have stayed up there for more than a year and survived and taken a while to adjust once they've returned, but have made it. So, you know, theoretically, they might have been able to do 2 years, but that would have been a record. And so every day past some point would have been new ground broken every day. And in some ways, I think it would have been interesting to see how long they could have lasted.
Was there? Do you think for them that there was ever a point where they thought that they would not get home?
No. Well, yeah, I was going to say no, but I think yes, there was one moment where they were sent up the footage of the foam striking the wing of Columbia, and foam had come off virtually every external tank and had bounced harmlessly off the shuttle. And when Endeavour had launched Expedition 6 up, several pieces of foam had bounced off the bottom of Columbia or of Endeavour and not fatally wounded it. So I think for them, suddenly seeing how lucky they were in some ways that they had survived because of chance and that their friends had died because of bad luck. I think that's when they realized, well, maybe they're not going to use the shuttle anymore. You know, maybe this is it. And I think they also had this moment watching, you know, Columbia coming down and listening to the final transcripts from the cockpit. Maybe we don't want to ride this thing anymore. You know, two of five are gone. 40% of the fleet has been lost, you know, in explosions. And so I think they probably did wonder, you know, if this ends, how will it end? And I think part of them also thought, I'd almost rather if it didn't end on a shuttle. But then if not a shuttle, then what? You know, there's only so many options.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, Batavia, Illinois, up in the northern part of Illinois. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys today?
Good.
Hey.
You know what? I've got a lot of history behind that shuttle program. I grew up with it. I'm originally from Lancaster, California.
Okay.
I don't know if you're aware of, you know, they tested out Edwards, and they built it in Palmdale, which is the next town over. But, you know, the shuttle, in fact, my father-in-law, he worked on it for years. And everybody I grew up with was basically involved in the shuttle program. And so when they first started testing these things years ago, they never tested anything where they could, you know, fly it without anybody in there. So it was like a, you know, an experiment to go up. So every time this thing goes up, it's basically breaking a record for existence. And I got to tell you, you know, I wish they could keep it going on just for the fact that it creates jobs, mm-hmm. you know, one. But the foam deal seems to be a problem. And now we're going back to another vehicle that looks something like the Apollo program.
Yep.
And I don't know if I like that idea as far as, is it going to cost us more or less? You know, that I watched Michael Griffin, by the way, all the time. I have NASA TV, so I'm into the NASA stuff. I live out here in Illinois because of job-related stuff, but I never, my folks and everybody live out there. And everybody I know that works somewhere in that kind of field out there anymore, everybody I grew up with, basically. And so there's a lot of the sciences out there, but it's lacking. It seems like the interest in the public is gone awry. They don't care about it anymore. They've got the war in Iraq. And I think it's a positive. You've got people in Mojave that are trying to build, you know, Bert Rutan, very smart guy. I call him a genius when it comes to aviation. He's trying to do something. You know, I mean, I want to see a space race again like it never had before, because I keep thinking you could put the private sector to work on this, create jobs that we have lost to other countries. And I was wondering, do you feel the same way? And is there ever going to be some kind of, you know, robust thing into space again? Because I don't see it in the Midwest. The people in the Midwest don't care.
No, I think you're right. You touched on a few things there. I think you're right that I don't think people care as much as they used to. And I think that is because space travel has become, looks routine in a lot of ways. I think that the trick that NASA has to do is do a better job, first of all, of selling itself. I think in some ways it's trapped in that military-industrial history it has and its bureaucratic, state that it's in now, and it doesn't do a good job of selling itself. I don't think people are interested in space, partly because of NASA. I sort of joke about it, but the press office, everyone in Houston has this language of acronyms they use. The press office at NASA, the acronym is IMPASSE, as in a chasm you cannot cross, a hurdle you cannot get over. And that's what the press office is. I mean, it's like beating your head against a wall. So that's one problem. The second issue is, I think you're right in that because there isn't a space race, that sort of, some interest faded because of that. When we were competing with the Russians instead of working with them, in some ways it was much more interesting. I think what you're going to see, though, is with China now entering the space race in some ways, and China talking about returning to the moon or going to the moon for the first time, in the near future, I think that might suddenly invigorate the American public's interest in space travel. And with President Bush saying we're going to go to the moon and then maybe Mars, I mean, I think if you talk about seeing a footstep on Martian soil, I think suddenly people will be interested. And I think if you suddenly start talking about the Chinese and Americans heading to the moon again, the optimist in me says a moon colony is such a big thing that maybe the world can be united behind that the way the U.S. was united behind Apollo. The pessimist in me, but in some ways it still works out for NASA, is that we don't work together and suddenly it becomes a competition again. So I think one of those two things should help spark something in the future. I think definitely that we're sort of in a lull. The shuttle isn't as glamorous as it used to be. We've lost two of them. It's sort of looked at with crooked eyes in a lot of ways. I think with the new vehicle, there might be some more interest developed. And again, I think returning to the moon and then talking about Mars, I think, should spark something too.
I thank you for letting me talk. I hope, wish you luck with the book. And
thanks very much.
And coming out and going and getting one. And I hope everybody listens to what you're saying. I would love to have you come up here and talk to people about it, because it's sorely lacking, and haven't grown up again with it for most of my life. I mean, I met Neil Armstrong, Pappy Boyington, Chuck Yeager, all these guys that people, when you're a kid, you don't care. But, I mean, I was involved in this because it was right down the street from me. And, it's amazing the older you get how much more you get into it than when you're in high school. You got other things on your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just hope people respect the interest of NASA and listen to Michael Griffin and other people like him, because I think he's a genius. But anyway, thanks again, guys.
No problem. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for the call. Just to go back to here, we got about 10 minutes, and I wanted to go back to a little bit of the story of what happened with the guys of Expedition 6.
Mm-hmm.
As we have said, that when the Columbia was lost in February of 2003, they would have to know right away that the shuttle fleet would be grounded for who knows how long. And in fact, it was more than 2 years before,
yeah, two and a half.
Before it flew again. So they would know, okay, well, one thing we know is that the shuttle is not coming to get us. Then the question is, well, okay, how are we going to get home? What eventually happened was that they used an old Russian Soyuz capsule that was attached there to the space station, which apparently was the best option, even though it was pretty old, and there was some question about how well it would serve. What were some of the other things possibilities that were discussed when people were tossing around ideas about how they might be able to, how on Earth they, NASA, Russia, would be able to get back up to the station to bring these men home?
See, I mean, the interesting thing in some ways is, although this is an incredibly complicated problem, how do we get our guys across this 250 miles of space? There are only so many options. The previous caller was talking about private enterprise and the vessels that are being developed privately. Those don't exist yet. So it's not like NASA could knock on someone's door and say, listen, we need you to rescue these guys. They did talk initially about sending a shuttle up. Should we do this? Should we send a short crewed shuttle up and just get them? And the fear then, of course, is, we don't know what caused Columbia's loss at this point. If the same thing happens again, if we lose a third shuttle, NASA almost certainly gets its plug pulled. I don't think the agency would survive that kind of accident. So that was scratched pretty quickly. Then it's, well, let's leave them up there. Let's just wait until the shuttle's ready to fly again. And then that was scratched for a couple of reasons, partly because of the food and water situation. The Russian, Nikolai Budarin, developed a heart murmur. And then the Soyuz capsule that's up there only has about a 6-month lifespan. It starts falling apart, which is a nice thought for the guys about to climb into it. But at this point, it was nearly 6 months. So NASA was suddenly faced with the possibility we either take this Soyuz now or they're up there for maybe 2 years. And, you know, facing those options, they decided that the Soyuz was the better bet. It wasn't a safe bet by any means. I think there was pride at stake because it was a foreign vessel. And again, it's sort of rickety in a lot of ways. When we were on the moon, the Russians were flying Soyuz. But it's also a workhorse, and it is there, you know, for emergency situations. And that's what they decided to use it.
Did the three guys, the two Americans and the Russian, these men of Expedition 6, did they get a vote if they had said, no, we'd kind of rather hang around here for a while? Or was it just a matter of someone decided and it was an order and they said, yes, sir, and they got into the capsule and went?
Yeah, it was an order. Their vote was that they wanted to stay. And for me, one of the most surprising things about the whole story is when I first started looking at it, I imagined myself in space station. I imagined myself, you know, wanting a shower, wanting to eat a steak off a plate, wanting to hug my wife and my child. And I thought it would be like being locked in the trunk of a car. You know, you'd be desperate to get out of there. And what surprised me is as I spoke to these guys, once Columbia is lost and once they started turning their minds toward this record-breaking mission of more than a year, maybe 2 years, that's what they wanted to do. They decided they wanted to break that record. And in some ways, life in the space station is this, you're living in this perfect little bubble. You know, your days unfold the way you want them to, and you're not bumped into on the sidewalk, and you're not caught in the rain or in traffic, and no one's telling you what to do. So they really wanted to stay. And in fact, the only argument they had, an idea was floated that maybe they send a Russian rocket up, they pick up two of the guys, drop off a new guy, but leave one of Expedition 6 up on the space station. And they argued over who got to be that guy. I thought they'd be arguing over who got to go home. But they argued about who got to stay. And that was the only time they came close to any kind of argument. So when they were finally told, you're coming home on the Soyuz, there was disappointment. Not that they were flying the Soyuz, but that they had to leave it all.
You know, Ed, when you're talking about this with colleagues, and it goes back to this question that for people who are not astronauts, what you think about is the basic stuff. You know, after thinking about, you know, what do you eat and how do you go to the bathroom, I think that a lot of people say, you know, they understand that there are things, that there are scientific missions that they do, there are experiments and things like that they do. And yet at the same time, I'm sure a lot of people say, well, yes, but really, what do you do? I mean, what do you do? You know, there's only so many experiments that you can do, and the basic tasks of life take up so much time. And then, as you say, you can't go out for a smoke. You know, you're there. What do they find to occupy their time? What do they do all day?
See, now, for a guy like Don Pettit, and again, talking about astronauts operating on different levels, I mean, Don, the science officer, operates on a different level. He doesn't think about the things the way you or I think about things. And for him, you know, it was like he was in this playground. He was in this giant lab where he could do anything. You know, he could open any door in the hallways of his imagination. And he spent hours conducting what he called Saturday morning science, because it was made up science. It was, you know, their mission had been scheduled for a certain length of time, and then after that, there was no more schedule. So, you know, it was this open-ended thing. And he, you know, would play with water or plants, or he'd just look out the window. I mean, he took 25,000 pictures. When you're in the space station, the sun rises and sets 16 times a day, and you can see, you know, plankton blooms in the ocean that look like art, or volcanic plumes, or you know, the Amazon emptying into the Atlantic. And I don't think you ever get tired of that. I mean, I think when you can wake up and look out your window and see the blue Nile meeting the white Nile, you know, suddenly life looks pretty good. So they do find a way to occupy themselves. And I have to say, you know, again, you can kind of make fun of them in some ways, but they were really productive. The other thing is the space station doesn't just fly itself. I mean, it requires constant maintenance and upkeep, and it's also a ship. You know, it there's propulsion systems to keep it in orbit and so on. And so that's the other thing they occupied themselves with, was keeping this machine in as good a shape possible to make, you know, to last them as long as they needed it to last them.
We're just about at the point where we have to end. One thing I just wanted to ask you real quick about is I understand this has been optioned to be a movie?
It has. A company called Working Title, which is part of Universal, has optioned it, which, you know, again, selfishly I'm happy about for me, but I'm also hopeful that, you know, it gets made into a movie, and maybe it's the kind of thing, you know, like Apollo 13, where it sort of sparks a renewed interest in space travel. So, you know, it's a couple of years away, I think, even if it does get made. But I'm optimistic. They seem like nice, surprisingly nice people. I sort of expected them to be real jerks. But no, everything's been working out well so far.
And are you going to be involved in writing a screenplay?
I'm writing what is called a treatment right now, which is sort of a pre-script. It's like a story outline. So I'm writing that, and if I do a good enough job, then they're going to give me a shot of the script. Which I'd like, but it's also daunting in some ways because I've never done anything like that. But I figure if you get the shot, you may as well take it.
Right, right. Well, it's a good story, and I appreciate you giving us some of your time to talk about it.
Thank you very much for having me, David.
Chris Jones, and again, if you'd like to read the book, it is Too Far From Home, A Story of Life and Death in Space. It is published by Doubleday. Chris Jones has written for Esquire, also for the National Post, where he won an award as Canada's Outstanding Young Journalist. He wrote an article for Esquire that became this book that won the 2005 National Magazine Award for Feature Writing.